Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Alva.
I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
And you're listening to the New Statesman podcast. On today's episode, we discuss the planned easing of restrictions over Christmas, and you ask us about the Grenfell Inquiry. So we've promised this was coming for a while, that we would talk about the UK government's plans for the easing of restrictions around Christmas. I think it's already been clear from offhand comments in other episodes that we think it's maybe not the best idea, but we haven't spoken about it at length yet. And of course, this comes as there's quite a lot of speculation today. We're recording on Monday morning that London could soon be placed into tier 3 restrictions with cases rising in lots of parts of London. Anoush, I'll start with you. These plans for 3 households to bubble up over Christmas with no travel restrictions for a short period over Christmas, that came out a few weeks ago, but we haven't talked about it yet. Mm-hmm. What was your initial reaction when you heard about that announcement?
Well, I wasn't surprised that that was the announcement. I think it was sort of the people-pleasing element of it was in keeping with, I think, the way that the government has approached the pandemic from the start. So, you know, over the summer, there was the eat out to help out policy, and there's always been this pull between trying to stop the virus from spreading, but also trying to sort of keep people happy or sort of delay conflict between the government and their own backbenchers rather than, you know, really to do with public opinion, because we still know that public opinion is weighted towards, you know, wanting a stricter restrictions and being generally sympathetic towards lockdown style responses. So it is more to do with that kind of political conflict rather than with public attitudes. But of course, you know, there's that side of Boris Johnson's character that sort of wants to rescue Christmas and wants you to hug granny and, you know, these things that sound good on the front pages of the Daily Mail. So I wasn't very surprised that that was the response, but it was interesting because, you know, so many of the voices, including ministers and government scientists, have been extremely reluctant to sort of encourage it, haven't they? And they kind of rode back on it basically in the same breath as announcing it. So we know that it's probably not the best idea in terms of controlling the virus. And as well as that, it's acting as a barrier to sensible policies. So now that we have cases and hospitalizations rising rapidly in London, and it's expected that London is going to go into tier 3 restrictions, and actually probably by the time many of our listeners are listening to this, what I'm saying might be out of date, but one of the things that may have been holding the government back from doing that is it just doesn't really make very much sense to go into stricter restrictions only for them to be lifted completely for 3 households, you know, being together for a few days the week after next. So it's just that doesn't really make it very much sense. So I can see why there's been that to-ing and fro-ing over whether to change what's going on in London. And to be honest, as far back as when they introduced the new renewed tier system at the end of November, it was clear that there was a significant overlap in what was happening in many London boroughs and the places in other parts of the country that had been allocated to tier 3. Our data team did a really good graphic of this where it shows certain boroughs, especially Havering and Redbridge, Tower Hamlets, Barking and Dagenham were way ahead on the scale in terms of, you know, positivity rates and hospitalization levels than many, like a good bulk of the places that have been put in tier three. So I think there's been that sort of strange delay in doing what makes sense, because you have this looming period of many of the restrictions being lifted for everyone. And so I think not only is it a questionable policy in terms of controlling the virus and stopping January from being a very, very grim month potentially, but it also has affected the other restrictions that the government has been contemplating in the build up to that period.
The thing I found deeply kind of weird about the Christmas stuff, right, is obviously we've covered a lot of things that we've believed to be slow running car crashes, but I think this feels like the first time that I've covered something where it's just like, this isn't even a slow running car crash. It's just kind of visibly obviously a bad idea, because like, yeah, as like the Days TP shows, right, like the only reason to run London hot, as it were, is because we have a younger population here, we have slightly more bed capacity, and therefore, you know, to put it this morbidly, right, you can have a lot more prevalence and a lot more cases, and actually, to be honest, double a point, a lot more deaths, before you get to a point where hospitals have to start putting "we're closed" signs up. Parking for a moment the moral reasons, and indeed actually the economic reasons why I don't think that is a good approach, even if you somehow buy into the idea that that is, we've always been planning to diffuse millions of people from London, which, yeah, is a net importer of people the rest of the year, and therefore is a net exporter of people at Christmas, through this, like, I mean, I think the one upside of the government's plans is I think a lot of people aren't following it. Like, a lot of people will have very sensibly left earlier, whereas, like, the travel window is like someone going, I know, so this thing, which is a bad idea, is there some way we could potentially maximise how bad it could be? Because if you're not aware of what the travel window is, it seemed unlikely, but I feel I've gone down this thing of trying to explain it. So this idea that people will be able to travel only between the 23rd and the 27th, it's just like a thing where it's just like, you know, like, is this plan sponsored by the coronavirus? The whole thing is so obviously insane that...
I mean, it is literally like the government telling people, hey, everybody, you should all travel on the 23rd/Christmas Eve, and you should all travel back from where you've been on the 27th. How about everyone get on your trains, on your buses, all at the same time for a jolly holiday? Like, don't try to spread that out. Let's just, you know, do it in one big push. In terms of Northern Ireland, I don't think that there would be planes enough for Northern Irish people to all fly home in that tiny window. So from a logistical level, which you've written about before, Stephen, on a logistical level as well as a sort of virus spreading level, it's a really mad policy.
It's sort of like a macro version of the original 10 p.m. curfew. I'm sure you've both experienced this firsthand as well, but just sort of everyone spilling out at exactly the same time and just standing in the street outside, to the extent where you're sort of pressing against each other when you're getting through the door at the end, because the pub is so desperate to get you out by the time it's supposed to. It's just these sort of things that are not practically thought through, but are thought to sound like a good compromise.
I mean, I've been very interested in this question, being a Northern Irish person in London, and also, I suppose, in an age demographic, because I'm younger than the two of you. I think that I'm in an age demographic where people, you know, in their early or mid-20s don't tend to still live with their parents, but maybe live with flatmates or with strangers, or in sort of housing arrangements that like don't necessarily feel like home, even if you like the people that you live with. And so it's a whole chunk of people who sort of expect to go home for Christmas, a bit like students, which there is a lot of foresight on and provision for in terms of the window for them traveling being much bigger and testing being provided. But I think it just means that I've been particularly conscious of it. And for full disclosure, I got the first chopper out of London after after the lockdown, and have been self-isolating in Belfast for the past nearly 2 weeks. But I think that in some ways it's actually, I don't know if the two of you agree, I think it's one of the most interesting policy questions that we're facing because near the start of the pandemic, none of us were really very well placed to examine the government's decisions. And even in terms of a circuit break or something, a lot of the advice on that was retrospective. So we were getting the sage minutes and Keir Starmer was making various policy demands, but we weren't really having it in real time. Whereas I think on this one, you can really see, anyone can look at this and sort of think about whether the government is making the right call on it or not. And I think I wrote about it a few weeks ago, and I think I sort of understand the, I was speaking to people in Downing Street also from a personal capacity where I was thinking, you know, in mid-November, oh, will I be able to go home for Christmas? And all my friends are wondering if they'll be able to go home for Christmas. And I was speaking to someone in Downing Street about it at that point, and they were absolutely firm that people will be able to go home for Christmas, that they didn't have the details firmly decided at that point, but it was just a certainty that the government wouldn't stand in the way of people going home. And that person from Downing Street, who isn't actually from the UK, was determined to go home for Christmas, but was going to isolate for 2 weeks at the other end. But I think at that point, you could kind of understand the government thinking that maybe if people were anecdotally saying that they were prepared to break the rules to see their family for Christmas, that maybe they should make some provision for people doing that as safely as possible. But actually, the polling seems to suggest that that isn't really the case, that as we had more detail about the various options, as you mentioned, Anoush, it does seem like most people would prefer to not have a sort of quote unquote normal Christmas than to have much tighter restrictions in January. And that's, you know, and that's separate from the question of, rather than thinking of it as a trade-off, just, you know, whether it's sensible to do that at all at the risk of higher deaths and infections and the impact on the NHS. So it seems like potentially a misreading of the public mood on that one. And so it does mean that we're in a kind of strange situation where, like you were saying, Stephen, people are making their own minds up about what they're doing for Christmas. And basically, in most cases, people are differing slightly from the government's advice, like me, or are sort of being much tougher than the rules suggest. But I think one of the biggest examples that we've had of sort of personal decision making coming into it, because we can see this potentially disastrous government decision coming down the line, a lot of people are judging that it's probably not a sensible policy. Certainly it's at odds with what most other European countries are doing this Christmas, including, you know, Germany and the Republic of Ireland. But it means that people for the first time have to sort of go above and beyond the government rules to decide what is corona safe. And in that way, I think that, I suppose there are two things on it. I suppose firstly, that it's just another area where the sort of the privilege divides of coronavirus are really in evidence. Because I'm certainly very aware that I've been able to still work from home and self-isolate for 2 weeks. And I think that lots of people who are still planning on seeing their families over Christmas time plan on self-isolating for 2 weeks before they do so. But that is just an option not available to lots of people who keep the economy running, working in supermarkets or delivery jobs or taxi drivers, or just so many people don't have that option available to them.
What I think the Christmas thing sums up is like the government's inability / unwillingness to acknowledge that the coronavirus is not fair, perhaps because once you've acknowledged the reasons why the coronavirus is not fair, then it has implications for the rest of your governing agenda, right? In the most COVID-safe thing for people to do, if they were going to celebrate Christmas in a semi-normal way, is to have left the second the national lockdown ended. Obviously, that is not an option. Yeah, like just the thing that I found slightly surreal about this whole experience is before I worked in journalism, I worked in retail. I was talking with a friend of mine from those days who still works in the book trade about, you know, I was like, oh, you know, how's it been? How are people going in? And they were like, oh, you know, actually all right, because like lots of people want to support, they work in indie now, lots of people want to support the shop. So, but we were talking about the Christmas thing, and like there are no circumstances when I obviously sound different because I'm also from this city, but there are no circumstances in which I would have gone home having like been at the epicenter of a super spreading event, i.e. being in a shop that had been open doing its Christmas trade for the however many weeks before. Now, of course, there are no circumstances in which I would go home because I am, you know, lucky enough not to live alone or with strangers. And although I am starting to grow slightly tired of the wallpaper in this flat, it doesn't feel to me like there is a, in terms of like the kind of mental health, social responsibility. But like, if the government thinking was people are going to do it anyway, then they should have actively encouraged and cajoled businesses. I mean, God knows they did a lot of this encouraging and cajoling for people to return to offices to say, look, if logistically your employees can work from home, you should be encouraging them to transition gradually over the Christmas period, right? Which is slash was the safest way for people to do something, you know, kind of normal, which obviously like does create unfairnesses. But yeah, it's this like weirdness where we've entered this stage where like the Conservative government has decided that the one time that these like unfairnesses of market outcomes and birth are so iniquitous that you have to rewrite public policy in order to equalize those outcomes is when doing so has literally deadly consequences. I mean, it's just, the whole thing is ridiculous. And it comes back to the original sin, I think, of the coronavirus laws, which is, you know, kind of this refusal to not, instead of go like, you know, socialize with due care and attention, don't socialize. I essentially do what we do with almost every legislation to kind of do a, let's try and predict every possible outcome and criminalize or not criminalize some of them, which then leads you with this, yeah, weird situation where like, yeah, the worst thing that could possibly happen would be a large number of people going, okay, I've been told that I should board the first train out on the 23rd or the 24th, and that's what I'll do.
I think it's also, the thing I find remarkable is, you might disagree with this, but I think it's how little political pressure is necessary to force the government into this position. I mean, we know that there are lots of people on the government's backbenches who have increasing concerns about the tiered system and about restrictions in general, and who would be fiercely opposed to cancelling Christmas as it would be seen. And certainly there would be large parts of the media that would also strongly object. And the government was coming under pressure months ago to save Christmas. And Boris Johnson, given the kind of politician that he is, clearly wants to be the kind of politician who saves Christmas. But I think it is just quite remarkable that, you know, rather than even attempting to just make the case against, you know, if you judge that people might break the rules anyway, because they're so determined to have a Christmas, which we don't even know is the case from polling. I mean, if anything, polling suggests otherwise. But if you really think that that's the case, why not as a government try to tell people why not to do that? Why not try to tell them not to and make the case and sort of change hearts and minds on that, rather than just thinking, oh, well, if people have decided, then that's what we're going to do. You know, I think that that's sort of definitionally following rather than leading. And certainly, even the sort of the limited discussion that we had around the options for that in terms of higher restrictions in January and so on, all seemed to indicate a level of public understanding of this and the trade-offs, mm-hmm. that seemed to think that this wasn't really entirely necessary. And I think also it points to a problem which a lot of governments have had, whereby their messaging has operated on the level of rules and what you sort of legally can and can't do, which means that then people, rather than thinking about what's safe and what isn't and what they're comfortable doing and how they can mitigate risk in their personal interactions, just think in terms of what they legally can and can't do and what's in the rules and what isn't. And, you know, there was a really good piece on this months ago in the Irish Times about how there needed to be a much more sophisticated public conversation around risk. I mean, and that's in the Republic of Ireland, which now has the lowest incidence rates in Europe because of its recent approach. But even there, this public health expert was sort of making the case that if, for example, wearing a mask or staying 2 meters apart or doing all of those sort of mitigating things, maybe that's a tenth of the risk of just sitting indoors really close to somebody. Ultimately, if you do that 10 times, that's the same risk as sitting really close to somebody. And so rather than thinking about safe or unsafe in terms of, you know, sitting apart with a mask on, safe, sitting close with no mask, unsafe, people need to sort of be thinking about risk in the round and about reducing their social contacts in the round and so on. And so making their interactions safer, but also thinking in terms of how the safest thing is to be having fewer of those interactions. There were lots of other examples in the piece about sort of the discussions we needed to be having around behavior. And we just haven't really been having those. And it's like Mark Drakeford said when the circuit breaker lifted in Wales, that if people just think about the rules and think on the level of what they legally can and can't do, you won't have a robust virus response. It's more about people taking personal responsibility and weighing things up for themselves. But basically, I just think that because we haven't had that at all in the UK, or certainly not from the British government, it means that at this late stage, it's very strange that we're having this sudden drop in the level of restrictions and rules, and people are having to think about their own level of personal responsibility and weighing it up. But sort of the government hasn't equipped people terribly well for that. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon and leaders of devolved administrations are encouraging people to think things through a little bit before Christmas, and even Boris Johnson has slightly, but I don't think that the government has paved the way for that kind of decision making, and you know, it's sort of passing the buck onto individuals at a very late stage in our virus response.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to the New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
We've had a concisely worded question this week, simply Grenfell Inquiry ? Which is well timed because Anoush, you've written a brilliant piece about the outcome of the Grenfell Tower Inquiry. Can you just sort of tell us about the key findings of the Grenfell Inquiry so far and what your piece discusses?
Sure. Okay. Well, I think the questions formulation from our You Ask Us question is quite telling in itself, because it sort of shows that people don't really know what to ask about it. And that's revealing of how it's sort of been chugging along under the radar, particularly in a year like this. So at the moment, we're in module 2 of phase 2 of the Grenfell Inquiry. So phase 1 was done in 2018. And the findings came out from that phase in 2019, in October. And that was about the events on the night. So it was very much focused on the emergency service response, on sort of the building's layout and landlord's responsibilities, central government responsibilities. And there were 46 recommendations from that part of the inquiry that have been recommended. And Boris Johnson has agreed in principle to institute all of those recommendations, but so far the going's been slow. I think just 4 out of the 46 have been implemented in full, and all of those are to do with what emergency services can do differently. And I think you both might remember there was a fire safety bill in Parliament in September, and actually Conservative MPs voted against an amendment which was seeking to legislate for some of the recommendations. So for example, sharing the design of a building with the local fire service, carrying out regular inspections on flat doors and lifts and other parts of the building, and ensuring that there were evacuation plans for residents. Those things haven't been tacked onto the fire safety bill yet. So the process of implementing those original recommendations from the first phase of the inquiry has been quite slow going. And then we've had this, the beginning of phase 2, which has been this year, and that's gone completely, I'd say, under the radar. I mean, there are places covering the events, but of course, coronavirus and also the latest Brexit countdown have drowned out some of the findings. And to be honest, the findings in this part of the inquiry, which focuses on the materials used on the refurbishment of Grenfell Tower and how they were tested, how they were approved and advertised and sold and ended up being part of the refurbishment project, this part has probably revealed the most shocking things so far. So essentially, the manufacturer of the cladding and the two manufacturers of the insulation on the exterior of the building for its refurbishment, all of those materials have been under question for how valid the fire safety tests were on those materials and how they were marketed to the people working on the refurbishment. So that's the main thing. And that doesn't maybe sound particularly sexy, but it basically means that we have all of these internal emails from these companies that were manufacturing these products, essentially acknowledging that some of the marketing materials were manipulated. The fire safety test for one of the insulation products by a company called Celotex was actually rigged to make it more likely that it would pass the fire test. So there were magnesium oxide panels included in that fire test, which are non-combustible. So they basically helped it to pass. And those magnesium oxide, that board was not included on the fire test report. So that was misleading. And there's been some amazing testimony from people who worked there. So a guy who was 22 at the time in his first job, he said that he was being made to lie for commercial gain. And not to sort of show off about my writing, but I just encourage listeners who haven't been following this just to read the piece that we've put out on it, because it sort of sums up a lot of the shocking evidence from people within these companies about sort of the way that they were marketing these products and trying to shoehorn them into passing fire tests that would mean they would be safe for over 18 meter buildings, which is sort of the high rise test. And I should say that the companies like Celotex, who I just mentioned, deny wrongdoing and responsibility for what happened at Grenfell Tower.
It is a fantastic piece, and I would strongly urge everyone to read. It's obviously, health warning, will make you very angry. And so I've been following the hearings as and when I can, because even though, well, it's in this slightly weird stage where at the moment it's your beat and it will continue to be your beat, but I've known that it will swing back into mine at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
And I must say, I would urge readers, you don't have to, people shouldn't feel that they have to come up with an actual question. If there's just a topic they would like, something question mark is quite a nice jumping off point. One of the things which has made it harder for it to sort of have as much kind of currency is that it's at its kind of most legally difficult stage. Mm-hmm. I find it hard to imagine, from having listened in, and I think anyone who reads your piece in Ouch will find it hard to imagine, that at the end of this process, at least one company will not have a situation where the report then goes, this was akin to corporate manslaughter. I find it hard to see, from having listened in on many of the hearings, how the kind of unofficial final phase of this report will be various residents and other organisations suing various organisations for what happened. And I just find it very hard to conceive of a situation, just based on what we've heard already, where those cases won't be successful. And of course, as everyone will have seen, like, the second that someone like loses a court case on this kind of thing, and then suddenly like a bunch of people are like, oh, well, now we can say this thing and we've wanted to say for a while.
Yeah.
To me, the thing which continues to newly shock me every single time, despite the fact maybe it is new, but it's not new, I think, if you've been following this story at all, is that in your mind, you hear the word fire safety test and you kind of assume that at some point someone who does not work for a company turns up, you know, with some matches and some gasoline and tries to set it on fire. And I think, like, that's the important kind of the thing I think that I hope will be politically advocated for afterwards. It just feels to me the really clear story, and I just don't see why this is remotely surprising to anyone, but it clearly is that if the person whose job relies on the organization successfully selling the product is the person in charge of adjudicating its fire safety, it probably won't be fire safe. And we actually know, right, then that is not just true of high rises, that is true of, like, you know, if you're listening to this on your sofa, that is probably true of your sofa. And yeah, one of the things I continue to find a bit frustrating and painful about some of the, like, and obviously, like, there's people like Inside Housing doing, like, really brilliant coverage of this, but there's, like, a certain type of, like, reductive housing. And obviously, I have, like, a massive vested interest here as someone who's, like, basically lived in a block of flats of that kind for essentially most of my life. This kind of, like, flattening of the type of person who lived there. You know, it's just like, it's just like, you know, one of the dead was a marketing consultant, guys. It's bad enough that this, like, insulting neglect happened that led to them dying without, like, people being like, oh, it happened because this person was, you know, like, so ultimately, like, this is a story in which, like, many of the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire were poor, but which has, like, far-reaching implications across, you know, not just tower blocks, but, as I've said, sofas. I don't know why sofas is the beds. You can really tell I'm working from home, can't you? Yeah. My partner's music stand, actually that probably is fireproof, it's made of metal. It's such a huge hammer blow to this kind of, like, oh, I'm sure corporations can police themselves. Why do we need the state to do this type of regulation? Because, like, the doy, it turns out to be, like, lethal and dangerous to make people responsible for marking their own homework.
Yeah, exactly. Marking their own homework is a good way of putting it. So there are these independent bodies that certify and, you know, carry out the fire tests for these products. But a lot of the stuff that's come out of the inquiry in this stage of it has shown that there are a lot of problems with the way that they do certify the products. So there was one example where a body called the Local Authority Building Control was assessing the fire safety of, or was asked to certify the fire safety of Celotex's insulation, which was used on Grenfell Tower. And it took the sort of marketing bump from one of the salesmen of it word for word and put it in the certificate. And you know it's word for word because it even included his typo. And of course, this body would say that it was misled by the company, and it relies a lot on the manufacturer's honesty. So, you know, there is a question over where the fault lies. But you're totally right. There's a problem with the way that the industry is set up and the checks and balances on these manufacturers, which does show up the fact that there isn't proper or strong regulation. And even the building regulations can be interpreted in different ways as well. So there's all sorts of weaknesses in the system. And like you say, Stephen, it really, really does matter to everyone. You know, this isn't just a case of corporations trying to extract as much wealth out of a poor area or one tower block where lots of people lived who might not have as much cultural cachet as people who own their own houses or whatever. Like you say, there was a diverse picture of people living in that building. And also, the government is planning on building back better, isn't it? It's planning on infrastructure projects, house building. It wants to loosen planning regulations so that it can accelerate house building. It wants to do green refurbishments on housing. How on earth can it do all of these things unless the findings from this inquiry, whatever they will be, are taken seriously? And also, all of these plans that the government has for building affect everyone. And if we don't have a safe system for it, then everyone should care about this. And it's not just one story about one fire that happened on one night.
And yeah, it is a really brilliant piece of work and a really important inquiry. And I think, yeah, the thing I would say, genuinely would say this if it was a piece on someone else's website, if you haven't been following this, and it's understandable because, you know, it's a deeply upsetting and angering topic, and you want to get up to speed, then I think, like, the piece you've written is just, like, a brilliant encapsulation of the key things. The thing it really reminded me of as well, actually, was obviously I've been rereading the McPherson Inquiry this year because I'm doing this thing about racial inclusivity within the Jewish community. So I have reread every report on racial inclusivity and diversity. And there's one of the things McPherson talks about is the Metropolitan Police's canteen culture. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this, the stuff that people just kind of say and sort of accept as the default. And the thing that I really thought of reading your piece and just seeing all of the stuff together in one place in a kind of condensed period as opposed to hearing it in hearings in between other things, it was the canteen culture, this kind of, like, lol, fire test didn't go well, that kind of stuff. And yeah. I think, like, that to me is, like, the most shocking and the most important thing to fix is a situation where the kind of canteen culture of self-regulation was kind of, like, to not regulate. And obviously, yeah, with the more thing, yeah, that many the organisations involved deny wrongdoing, and although I think it is unlikely that every organisation involved will not have some kind of sanction, I'm sure Some of them won't. But I think it is ultimately the failure of self-regulation is like the big and really important story of the inquiry so far.
And I think a lot of people listening will find that really interesting, because I used to live around there and I used to go on the walks, the monthly remembrance walks for Grenfell. And this was a very sad and very political story from the very beginning. And it was immediately interpreted as this sort of big, horrific monument to the conditions that people were living under conservative austerity. And certainly the feeling on those walks was that this was a conservative problem. And certainly the politics, I mean, the very sort of sad events, remembering all of the different people who used to live in that tower block and who were so crucial to that community. But there's a definite political underpinning and a political interpretation of that event, as well as you say, systemic mismanagement and systemic failures. And certainly the widespread interpretation is that it's also a story of systemic racism or institutional racism. And I think that it'll be clarifying for some people that regardless of those other things, because we haven't touched on those, but one of the big threads coming through that hasn't always been present is that this is revealing of a huge systemic problem, but it's the one that the two of you have been identifying above all, of sort of corporate greed or corporate mismanagement, systemic failures in certain corporations' responsibilities to the people that they are serving and selling their products to. And I mean, Grenfell will just loom large as one of these huge, very symbolic moments of the 2010s. And I think we'll keep interpreting it, but this is a sort of newer interpretation that's coming to the fore, and that will slightly be refining people's top lessons that people are taking from this.
There's that focus on profit making, but then of course there's austerity is a big part of the story. So why did they swap out zinc panels for aluminium composite panels to save £300,000 on this refurbishment? You know, so there are aspects of it where money saving was put above safety, where you wonder where that comes from. And of course it's because there's not as much money in local authorities as there used to be. So austerity is definitely part of the story.
Yeah, and I tell you, someone who has found a lot of the, I would say, quite glib commentary about Grenfell quite upsetting, to be honest, because I just think it's incredibly revealing, these people who are basically what they're going is like, people who live in council houses, we all know about them, they're all black and poor. Congratulations, you've certainly revealed something about politics. But actually, like, the underlying story of that we're seeing in the inquiry, and actually I think was actually fairly clear from, if you read the blogs of the Tenants Residents Association, if you look at it right from the off, was a failure of regulation of the kind of, like, whether you want to call it the Thatcherite model or the neoliberal model. But actually the central thing is the kind of peeling back of state regulation. And as Anoush says, right, austerity is part of the story of why other councils are in. So one of the things we've kind of been lucky, there is no reason why we haven't had a Grenfell Tower style situation in student housing, much of which has got this kind of the same sort of like polyethylene cladding that may be problematic on it. The only reason that hasn't happened is luck. And in all of those like near misses, austerity is a much bigger part of the story, right? Like, why is it that new housing developers and local councils and universities like have a pile and high, sell them cheap approach to student accommodation? Well, it's because they've had huge cuts to their direct grants and they're desperately looking to find and make money elsewhere. In some ways, Kensington and Council is such a weird situation because they weren't cash strapped. But in some ways also, these councils, you know, these conservative councils in London, which have like been considered like these flagships for how you can do more with less, right? In some ways, that both is and isn't the austerity story. It's not the story of austerity because that doing more with less wasn't about a restriction in grants or a local authority having less money. But it is about it because the argument then underpins like, it's fine that we've taken this council's direct grant. Yeah, we've cut this council's direct grant. Is this idea that these councils were a successful model of municipal government?
Yeah.
And, you know, the evidence then it wasn't is, you know, quite literally however many metres high.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleagues Anoush Shakelian and Stephen Bush. We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.